Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mugs at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 31st of August. This is episode 75. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Simon Breeny, the foe of Julian Burnside QC, AO.
And AO.
AO and QC.
That's important to note.
You guys might have heard that story. So Simon's going to go into a bit more detail. He's also going to start talking about what he wants to see out of the Scott Morrison Prime Ministership. We're also going to be talking to Rebecca Lowe from the Institute of Economic Affairs in the UK about all the exciting stuff the IEA is doing, especially with young people and a new think tank within the think tank Freer. Really cool stuff. And we get into a lot of the differences between British politics and Australian politics because they do a whole lot of cool stuff with politicians. But let's get into it, Pete. So after last week that we broke the website, again, apologies to Sammy.
Again, I don't apologize to Sammy.
Then we broke the internet. So the IPA released its most successful video of all time.
Yep.
Over 235,000 views in like less than a few days.
Yep.
It was basically detailing what the IPA wanted to see out of a Scott Morrison prime ministership. Basically, you know, congratulations. Now, here are the policy positions we would like you to see. There was a lot of stuff about the dignity of work, a lot of stuff about energy policy and freedom of speech. Mm. And 235,000 views. It's awesome.
Still growing as well.
Still growing. 8,000 views overnight. Twitter went sick, I would say, Pete.
There was a lot of, I don't know if I can say butthurt on the podcast.
You can. I'll allow it.
There was a lot of butthurt on Twitter about the IPA doing that video. By the way, we're going for 250,000, so send it to your friends.
Yep. We'll probably get 250,000 by tomorrow.
Well, that's awesome because I'm no mathematician, James.
No, I've never accused you of being such.
Okay, well, make sure
you
don't.
I've accused you of a lot of things. Being a mathematician, not a lot.
250,000 is 1% of Australian population.
Ooh.
So 1 in 100 Australians have seen this.
Wow.
It's not. I mean, it's not that many. Be better.
Yeah,
if it's like
I think 225,000 is probably a better number than one. What? Yeah. Okay. No, very cool, Ben.
Yep.
Well
so
done.
Let's keep going.
I was going to say, because I'm not in the video.
What do you think that was?
Well, just, you know, you've seen me. But Pete is in the video. So, Pete, what's it like being a video star?
Oh, look, it was good. I think I had two lines. The original draft had a couple of actual policy prescriptions for me, but that got cut. And it ended up, I got the most important bit at the end, which was, what was it like? So, it's over to you now, Prime Minister, or something like that.
Oh, that is very important.
And, you know, we don't have the neck anymore. So, I think my menacing... You know,
it's a towering glare.
Yeah, it's pretty. I just imagine we were we had the opposition 9 wickets down. We needed one more wicket, and I was putting on the boys. It's on you blokes now, right?
And that's they're all gassed out there. Yeah, it's been a hot day.
Oh, look, it's hot. Yeah. So what? It's a summer sport.
Anyway. That's Pete's message to Scott Morrison. Now, one thing I do want to discuss with some of the Twitter butthurt, as Pete so eloquently put it.
Yeah.
Peter Fitzsimons, one of Australia's foremost bandana wearers, tweeted out. This is a must-watch video, so thank you, Peter. The IPA gives the PM his marching orders. I don't see it like that. And then blah, blah, blah. I particularly like the one male rebel, the absolute wild maverick who doesn't wear a tie. Now, there was only one male in that video not wearing a tie.
Yeah, I love the way he specified that.
And that was Peter Gregory.
Otherwise, it could have been Bella. well, you know.
Bella is a absolute wild maverick, so.
She is, yeah.
So, Pete, do you now, like, is that going on the CV? Like, you know, special comments from Peter Fitzsimons, male rebel?
I definitely intended to be a wild maverick when I got dressed that morning. But isn't it just, like, am I the only one who thinks this is, like, just a little bit rich coming from a bloke that wears a bandana 24/7 to prove that he's different to everyone else?
Yep.
That's a little bit rich.
Yeah. Also, just like absolute wild maverick. Like, I just love that turn of phrase. Like, I'm now just going to call Pete absolute wild maverick for the rest of the show.
I'm happy with that.
Yep.
Mav.
Mav for short. No, yep. I don't think we shorten it. It's absolute wild maverick. Cool. So
just one more point about the videos. We did our interview with Douglas Murray is currently on 31,000 views.
Oh wow, that's also shot up.
And Lindsay Shepherd gave us a shout out in her video. Recent video on YouTube.
Yeah, cool.
So thanks, Linz.
Yeah, so if you are and you listen to the show and you missed the Douglas Murray interview, then you can go back about 2 weeks on the show. You can also watch us on YouTube interview him in full. All 54 minutes is up on YouTube as well. Cool. So let's move on. So the other story that's been playing around a lot in the media is this article. I've got to get the pronunciation of this magazine right because it's spelt Honey Soit, but it's not. Nina, what is it again?
Honey.
Honey. Honey soir.
Is that right?
Honey soir.
Honey soir.
You want to have a go, Pete?
Oh, look, you guys have done a really good job.
Okay, but Honey soir is a student magazine out of the University of Sydney.
That's right.
And there was one article from Jay Tharapel. He's a Sydney University academic, former lecturer, I think is the idea we're going for here. But certainly involved.
PhD student
as well. And he was on a junket to North Korea. And he wrote about how energized and efficient the country is and how great it is.
Yeah.
And it's one of those ones where, like, you know, stupid article written by an academic in a university newspaper. Like, we could do that segment every week, but this one really jumped out.
Yeah, I don't think... I mean, academic's probably verbaling a bit because he's still a PhD student, but he's not...
But you're an academic, Pete.
No, I'm not. That's why I know that he's not. But he's not an undergrad student.
Right.
Like, he's a PhD student. So I put him in the kind of old enough to know better bracket.
That's a good bracket, yeah.
But... Yeah, it was pretty bad, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I've got three passages that really jumped out at me as funny. So make sure you guys, like, the article's still up. They're not taking it down. So go read it.
What a brave stand.
What a brave stand against the tyranny of the West. So the first passage I want to read, so he's talking about his trip. So he goes, most foreigners go through Koryo tours and get shown the absolute best of the country. But because we went through the DPRK Committee for Cultural Relations with Foreign Countries, they showed us a lot more of daily life.
Oh, yeah, like you'll definitely get a full picture from they'll
give you the bad stuff through the DPRK Committee for it.
They sound pretty independent.
They sound very independent. So he's going, like, you know, humble farming households, department stores, educational facilities. So we already get, like, the sort of doe-eyed Western guy going, like, maybe North Korea isn't the tyranny we've been told it.
Mm.
So he goes on to say, we visited Mekok Cooperative Farm near Suriwon City, where we were supposed to do some farm work. But when we got there, the farmers told our guides they'd rather we not, because it's hard enough farming in North Korea without some academic who's never been into a field picking up a flower. It's like, no, put that down.
That's okay. Like,
I can't afford this.
I didn't know what to make of that bit. I never thought of that. Thank you for explaining it to me.
It's just really, like, funny to me. Because he's putting it as, like, you know, oh, they didn't want us to work. They just wanted us to see what they were about. It's like, no, they just did not want you to stuff it up for them.
Yep.
They're already starving. They don't want to be more starving. And then the last part was, the way Pyongyang sees it, the army that murdered a third of their population and completely leveled the country during the Fatherland Liberation War still occupies their nation. Now, he's saying that as a US, like, the US is bad, but it's like, yeah, the force that killed a third of the population is still in charge. Yeah. They are. They're in charge of North Korea.
Yeah. Well, I love the way he adopts the terminology of the North Korea.
Yeah. So he's
like, I don't think South Korea called the Fatherland War.
No, the Fatherland Liberation War.
Sorry. Yeah.
So, which to me tells me that he's gone up to a North Korean and go, do you feel that the force that killed a third of your population is still in charge? And this North Korean's just looking around at all the posters of Kim Jong-un and going, like, yeah. Mate, look around you.
And you seen that palace?
I can't be talking to you anymore or they'll shoot me.
Yep.
It's a really funny article. Make sure you guys go read it. It's getting a whole lot of play. There was also Renee Gorman, one of our campus coordinators. She was on the Bolt Report 2 nights ago, I want to say. Or Wednesday night. So she was talking about that. So go back on our Facebook page and watch her take it to task.
Yes, Renee. Oh, sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, so as she points out, like, we can laugh at this article, and we have, and I will continue to do so later. But the serious point that's being lost here is, like, you know, this guy was a tutor. He's obviously got friends of his who are also tutors. This is the stuff that gets into the media, but what isn't getting into the media? What's just getting taken as read in classrooms about North Korea and all these other totalitarian dictatorships?
Renee explains it really well in that interview. She also makes the point that this is the university that rejected Western civilization education because it was unacceptable. My favorite bit from this is when he says, you know, we talked to the Syrian ambassador and to the Cuban ambassador, and they said, you know, North Korea's not that bad, as if these two are going to give us a fair picture.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
Shall we go to Bjorn Lomborg?
Yeah, let's go to Bjorn Lomborg. So normally we don't sort of just pick out an article and go, oh my God, how good is this article? But this was such a good article, I believe, that I think it was worth doing that. Bjorn Lomborg had an article in the New York Post this week, which is, I didn't realise, but the New York Post opinion pages are awesome.
Yeah.
There's heaps of good stuff in there. Check it out. And it was called How the...
Good sport coverage too, if you are into the US sports.
Yeah, I didn't realise that you were into US sports. Yeah. This is the first time you mentioned that.
Yep, absolutely.
Bjorn Lomborg go on.
How's Melbourne?
Yeah, well, yeah, go the way it is. Bjorn Lomborg, I should mention, a former IPA guest. So this article is called How the War on Climate Change Slams the World's Poor, which is a really good point. And so Bjorn Lomborg, as we know, he thinks that climate change is a problem and he thinks that humans are changing the climate, but he just thinks it's not the biggest problem that we face. So he's hardly, you know,
biggest environmental problem that we face. Like, not
Not even the biggest environmental problem, let alone the biggest problem we as a race face, as a human race face. So, you know, he's not a climate skeptic at all. So he's just saying the measures intended to fight climate change are actually a lot worse for the world's poor than the measures, than what climate change will be. And he points to this study, and I'll get the name right, from the Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Austria. It was published in Nature Climate Change, and it came to the figure that climate change, if left unchecked, will push 24 million people into hunger or danger of being affected by hunger by 2050. And a global carbon tax or a global emissions trading scheme will put 78 million people into danger of being hungry.
Yeah, and then it goes on to say, like, if you want evidence of this playing out, because a lot of that's projection, then 10 years ago when everyone was like, oh, biofuels are going to save the world,
exactly,
like,
right,
that put 30 million people into poverty and 30 million more into hunger because, you know, crops were being replaced with biofuels so they could sell it to the West.
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, it does actually do some real damage.
And he has a few other examples there. Bangladesh, talking about, you know, there's currently this activists trying to get Bangladesh to stop using coal, which will have a bad impact for them. But I just don't understand how you could read this article and ever lose an argument with a friend or a colleague about the impacts of climate policies ever again.
Mm.
Like, surely it's you to say, what do you say to those people? Walk into this horrible shack they live in and explain to them how it's important they don't have electricity.
I did actually have this a few nights ago. And they said, if we don't do the carbon tax, the governments are just going to keep the money anyway. Like, they signed up for the carbon tax, so they're not. They don't want to.
So anyway. It really struck me as a great article, and I think that's the line of argument people out there should use.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to read it, go back into Hey, What Did I Miss? From yesterday, or just you can also access it from the website, or just Google the Bjorn Lomborg article. But if you do go through Hey, What Did I Miss? Then Pete and I get the stats, so please do that.
We're on commission here, so
work on clicks. Cool. So this last story... it's still developing. It's still a lot of, like, he said, she said kind of stuff to it, but it is very funny.
Yep.
So Peter Dutton, you know, the guy that nearly became prime minister and, you know, at the very least is like the scourge of the immigration ministry,
exactly.
The bad guy. Turns out he defied his own department's advice in intervening to grant a visa to a French au pair staying with AFL boss Gillon McLaughlin's relative.
Yep.
So it's this woman, Alexandra Duell. She's from France. She's 27 years old. She'd previously been counseled by Australian authorities on not working in the country while on a tourist visa. She does so anyway. She's about to get deported. Gillon McLaughlin's second cousin, I think it is, or some relation, goes to Gil, say, buddy, can you help me out? Gil goes, yes, and emails Peter Dutton.
That is so bad.
Emails Peter Dutton. Peter Dutton steps in, and I think the visa was granted. Like, again, this is still developing. That's the stuff we know.
Yeah.
The reason I find this funny is that Gillon McLaughlin is the new age AFL guy.
Like, that's exactly right.
So
you've
got
exactly
Peter Dutton, the scourge of immigration, intervening to keep someone in the country.
Pure evil.
Yeah. And then you've got Gillon McLaughlin, new age. Like, we consulted Waleed Ali on the rule changes. we had Bashir Hooley and Adam Saad do the coin toss 2 days after that idiot made that speech.
He's a massive lefty.
He's a massive lefty until you need a favour.
How can, and I can just see lefties' heads explode.
Oh, yeah.
How can a bloke with hair so beautiful consort with someone so evil?
This will sink the room at the next Turak cocktail party when he enters the room.
Yeah, exactly.
How could you possibly do a deal with the devil?
But Gil McLaughlin's hair, seriously.
Yeah, it's
beautiful.
Yeah,
so his luscious.
Eyes, yeah. But he's also ruining the sport, so I don't want to give him too much credit. So, yeah, very funny.
Yeah, that's the thing about it. Like, I mean, this is mostly just a funny story.
Yes. I don't really have a lot to say.
It's bad when
there's no policy positions I can really take from the Peter Dutton au pair scandal.
Yeah, I mean, it's bad when the big end of town consorts with politicians.
Oh, that's true. But also, would be my main overarching point. Cool. So the other thing I want to say before we get into the interviews. So, Great Books Podcast. Well, as we discussed with John Roskam yesterday, it went bang. It went number one in the charts. I think it's now at number 5. It's cooled down a little bit, but that's just, the second album's the hardest one to follow.
Yeah, everyone's finished the book.
Yeah. So, we just wrapped this morning on Heart of Darkness. Also yesterday we just released, so it's public, The Leopard. So make sure you're going out and subscribing to that. That's available on iTunes and Podbean. There's some really great discussions. We're getting a whole lot of great feedback from listeners. So make sure you are downloading.
Just don't get mixed up with the nightclub in Phnom Penh. It's okay. Heart of Darkness, the book, not the nightclub in Phnom Penh.
That's a different podcast of me and Peter presenting.
Yep. Anyway,
some dark, dark days. That is all we got for the start of the show. So we'll now go to those interviews. But before we do...
Should we say that we're on John Bachelor this morning?
Peter and I were on John Bachelor this morning.
And, so check it out.
We've got some stories from it, but that's for another day. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, and you can also access it through the website. So make sure you're subscribed on any of those platforms. Make sure you are reviewing us if you're on iTunes. And if you are listening on iTunes, you've been trying to get some friends and family to listen to the show, but they just have not got iTunes. Make sure you're telling them that we're also on Spotify and Podbean. Now, Nina, pressing the button for us, as always, if people want to make a financial commitment to the IPA or if they want to become members of the IPA, where can they go to do that?
Just visit the website, ipa.org.au, and click on that join or donate button. And by becoming a member, starting as low as $22 a year, you become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. Let's go to those interviews. Okay, we now welcome back to the show, IPA Policy Director Simon Bruni. Welcome back.
G'day, James. G'day, Pete.
Good to see you, mate. Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
All right, so you've had a bit of a run-in with Julian Burnside. Now, this story is getting a bit of play.
Julian Burnside, AO.
AO.
QC.
QC. Yeah.
It's
any others? Now, there's a lot of acronyms on this show. Anyway, the point is, Julian Burnside likes to see himself as the face of the intelligent left, I would sort of see it as. And he had a bit of a moment with you this week. Now, the story's got a bit of play on the Bolt Report, and people might have been following it on Twitter, but just for people that haven't seen it, tell the story as you saw it.
Yeah, so look, just for a bit of context, so Julian and I were two members of a four-member Q&A-style event that took place at Melbourne High School last Friday. And we were there to answer questions for an hour, as you see on, no doubt, those of us who watch the ABC's Q&A are familiar with that kind of program.
All where, seven of them are nodding yes.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. So the students in the class were...
But okay.
I think it's about 250 these days.
Okay.
Well, because they make ABC employees watch it, so 250,000 straight up, and it's hard to get anyone else outside of that.
And then they've got their mum at home, making sure that she... replays the video over and over and over.
We definitely
get those picks up. Yeah. We were involved in this Q&A event. The students were there to ask questions and participate as audience members. And one of the questions was about climate change and was about Peter Ridd. So Professor Peter Ridd is a friend of the IPA in this program and someone who has been treated appallingly by James Cook University. I pointed that out and I said that there were significant issues from an academic freedom perspective.
Yeah,
on...
so just to expand on that, just in case people missed that one. So Peter Ridd, do you want to just explain?
Yeah, so Professor Peter Ridd is a marine biologist who was formerly employed by James Cook University. He was fired by James Cook University. The case itself is complicated, but essentially he's fired because he came out against some of his colleagues and he put a different view on the science of the Great Barrier Reef to some of his colleagues. The university has got its arguments about whether or not there's an appropriate way to do that. In my view and a lot of people's view, the way that Peter Ridd went about it was pretty reasonable. He wasn't abusive in any way. He wasn't unreasonable. He was just looking at the science and saying, this is what the science says.
Yeah, and for people listening, we talked to Rowan Dean about this a fair while ago. We really got into the points of that one. So if you do want to hear more about Peter Ridd, you can go back and listen to the Rowan Dean interview. But, sorry, it comes up in this debate.
So, anyway, that comes up in this debate. And then the question is about freedom of speech, academic freedom, and climate change. And Julian Burnside's turn to answer the question is after mine. And he gets a couple of minutes into his answer, and then he starts talking about this figure that most of us would have heard of, that 97% of climate scientists agree that climate change is happening and that humans are causing it. Now, all I said to him as he was delivering his response was, Julian, where does that figure come from? Do you know where that figure comes from? Because I wanted to ask him why it was that he thought that that was a compelling statistic, because even if the figure itself, I mean, that seems like a high figure, right? But if you actually start digging a little bit deeper and you ask, well, what exactly is it that they agree on? Do you think that it means that 97% of them agree that the policy prescription that you might put forward let's say, burning, banning fossil fuels,
yeah,
is also supported by the 97%. So there's all of this complexity that's tied up in that figure. So I asked him, where does that figure come from? And he turned around to me and said, I didn't interrupt you, which is untrue because I heard him mumbling over in the corner about something. He didn't ask me a question in the middle of my answer, but I could hear him, and I ignored him and continued and finalized my response. But he said, I didn't
interrupt you. So technically he didn't interrupt you because you didn't let him interrupt you.
Yeah, that's right. And I repeated the question. And when I repeated the question, I think what was going through his mind is, gee, I don't actually know where the figure comes from, and I'm not sure that I'm prepared with an answer to this question. But rather than saying, I'm not prepared with an answer to the question that you're asking, he turned around and said, you can shove your freedom of speech up your A and F off.
I mean, it was an either-or situation. He either said, there were two options that presented themselves. You either say, I don't know, or just abuse.
Yeah.
Just straight abuse.
Imagine if you were one of like the 16-year-old kids, you would have been like, yeah, adult swore. Yeah.
I thought you were going like, yeah, someone finally gave it to Brini.
Oh, well, you know.
That was my reaction in the back of the room.
Some of them definitely had that view. So, look, I was actually a bit shocked because I've had quite a few interactions with Julian Burnside, and they've always been pretty friendly. I mean, we probably couldn't disagree on more things than we do, but our arguments have always been fairly cordial. Our debates have always been pretty cordial.
Yeah, like no one saw that in Julian Burnside's arsenal.
To use
one of his words, but yeah.
The kids didn't either. I mean, there's sort of been this ongoing feud about what actually happened and in the aftermath. And he clearly lost the room. I mean, even these kids who probably more of them agree with Julian Burnside's perspective on these things than mine, but he clearly lost them. And I think there's a pretty easy explanation for why that is. If you are seen to be just abusing someone and using ad hominem attacks, then I don't think people take you as seriously as they might otherwise.
And what happened subsequently? He said...
Well, actually, before we get into the subsequent Twitter spat, can I unpack two other things that he said?
You can.
Then he goes, thank you.
Sorry.
Then he goes, I've always wanted to say that in a school.
So this was a really, really weird thing to say. I thought it was a really weird thing to say.
I definitely said stuff like that at school. So.
he did follow it up with, I've always wanted to say that at a school. And he sort of looked around. And then he said, to Simon Brini. It was really weird. It was a very strange...
There's so many stipulations in that. Yeah. Like, I want to say it, but we also have to be at a school and Simon Brini has to be the butt of it.
There's so many conditions to be met here.
Yeah.
It's a very specific
goal.
I think what was happening was he knew that... So in the first instance, he didn't have an answer to the question. In the second, he didn't want to give the real answer. And then in the third, when he realized he'd lost the room, he was sort of trying to backpedal. And rather than backpedaling, he actually doubled down.
Mm-hmm. Which is why
he said, I've always wanted to say that. Yeah. I'm sure that thought has never actually come into his mind before.
No, I like to think he's
get up out of bed. Here's the list of things I've got to do today.
Yeah, brush tea, get
tell milk. Tell someone to F off in front of year 11 students.
Yeah. That's one interpretation. My one that I like is that he goes, well, I've been found out here, might as well live out my childhood dream.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So look, I mean, I think there are quite a few things going through Julian's mind, and admitting that maybe he didn't have an answer to the question was certainly not one of them.
Cool. And then this leads to the Twitter spat.
Yeah, exactly. So, afterwards, I sort of undenied a little bit about whether I would tweet about it. But then I just thought, look, you know, I think more people should know about this sort of interaction going on, because it's much more likely that when you have a panel such as the one that we were on, that it's going to be the person on the left who is going to shout abuse than it is the person on the right. These days, I just think that is, if you're from, you know, the IPA or the CIS or the Australian Institute of Progress, or, you know, there's any number of organisations, it's not going to be that guy that hurls abuse at whoever the left winger happens to be on the
panel. I'm trying really hard to balance that, but it is more often the left wing organisations.
And if you did it, you'd be held to pay.
you sort of want to be up, you want to be able to balance that out, right? Because you feel as though, as a fair-minded person, you should be able to say, yeah, you know, Julian did that, but then there was this other guy on the right who did it, and, you know, it sort of all evens out in the end. It doesn't. It actually doesn't. And I think that more people need to recognise that the scales are tipped, and people on the left feel much more comfortable engaging in this way. I think it's a disengagement, actually, from debate, but they feel much more comfortable doing this than anyone on the right does. I mean, you know, certainly if you were on the, as you say, if I had done that, I think that there would have been fewer people on Twitter saying, yay, good for you, than there were. So once I did tweet it, there were thousands of interactions. And most of them came out to say, good on you, Julian, for, you know, for saying it. I think that's really disappointing, not only for Julian. If I saw that and I recognised that that's probably not the way to interact with someone in a polite discussion, I'd be really disappointed, not only in myself, but also in all of those people who hold me up saying, you know, congratulations in doing what you've done. But I also think it's a really poor reflection on where the state of debate and discussion is in 2018.
Yeah. So, like, that's the one where it's... So you've got all the people on Twitter who are going to go, yeah, you stick it to Bruni. And then you've got the secondary people who are going to be looking... Yeah, stick it to Bruni. Hashtag stick it to Bruni.
Hashtag created, actually.
We'll get there. It's time. But then, yeah, you've got the second level of people who don't really know which side is right, but then they just look at the people and one side's chanting all this abuse and one side is, and they go... Okay, I'm going to go side with the isn't.
Yeah. That's right. And look, to be fair, and I really do want to say this, that there was one person who I noticed, and there may have been others, but there was one person I noticed who came out and said, you know what, this is not okay. And her name is Emma Dawson, and she is the executive director of Per Capita. Now, Per Capita is a left-wing think tank. Emma Dawson is someone who is very well respected on the left. She is someone who has done a lot of great work at Per Capita, and Per Capita is a quite respectable left-wing think tank. But, you know, as I've just said, it's a think tank that doesn't align with the IPA's values. And so I think it's really important that she actually came out and said, this is not okay, this is not the way that we should interact with one another. It's unfortunate that she is one of, you know, maybe there were two or three others and 1,000 people on the other side, which I think just shows this tribal idea that if someone on your side who is a part of your tribe has done something, even if it's bad, you've just got to back them in.
The worst thing that was lost in all this, and I don't want to verbal Julian Burnside because he's a very powerful lawyer, but in his tweet he said right at the end, you know, Simon believes in an extreme version of freedom of speech where academics who are sceptic of climate science have the right to say whatever they want, but yeah, they shouldn't because climate change is dangerous. It's like, hang on, what?
So what was really weird about it is that Burnside obviously felt as though he couldn't be honest about what actually happened in the room. So he must know that his response to what actually happened in reality was unreasonable. So a couple of things to say about that. One, he talked about the fact that, and I've seen him do this in a couple of tweets, and one of them was in response to Emma Dawson. One of the things that he said was, Simon talked about the idea that climate deniers should be able to be heard whenever and wherever they like. Now, that's not the kind of language that I would really ever use. And B, that's actually explicitly incorrect. What I said was, I'm not convinced that this is a clear-cut case of freedom of speech, but I do think that there are really significant concerns when it comes to academic freedom. I just think he either... I mean, what I think has happened is he's just decided, I've just got to build this false reality to try and justify my behaviour. But I think that's also a really interesting reflection, that even if he had been honest, he feels as though he couldn't do that because if he did that, then people would say, well, you were unreasonable. Which I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's true. I mean, if he had been honest about what happened, I think his supporters would still have said, yeah, good on you, you've done the right thing.
Yeah. Like in his supporters' minds, well, some of his supporters' minds, all you have to do is say, hi, Julian, how are you? And if he can just like torrential abuse, they'd be like, brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. It's unfortunate because it's such a low bar for intellectual honesty and debate and rigor. And I'm glad that, frankly, I'm not held to the same standard.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's change tracks unless you've got anything more to ask about this one. Cool. So, crazy last week in Canberra. We've already talked about the spill, and we talked about the IPA's video. So what did you make of it? What do you want to see out of the Scott Morrison prime ministership? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, that's a really good question. I've got to say, I would have loved for there to be more changes to the front bench. I would have loved to have seen a new generation Liberal Party, because I think that there won't be too many opportunities while you're in government to try and essentially do what footy teams do, and that is blood new talent. And I think that's really disappointing. You've essentially got the same team. There have been a couple of people that have been brought in. There have been a couple of people that have been pushed off the front bench. But essentially, it's a very, very similar team to the team that existed under Malcolm Turnbull when he was Prime Minister.
There is getting to be a bit of like, what was that all for?
Yeah, exactly. No. Exactly. And that gets to a deeper problem, which is that I don't necessarily think that the personnel changes are important, but I do think that policy changes are. And if we're not going to see personnel changes, then it's less likely that we'll see policy changes. But I would like to see a few significant changes made, because I think this is an important opportunity that Prime Minister Morrison's been given. I don't see a huge amount of evidence thus far that a lot will change, but I'm hopeful for him and the team.
Yeah. So like that's what like people are asking me, like, oh, what do you make of it? And I again, it's just the three main candidates were all the same for a policy perspective. Like, none of them wanted to get out of Paris. None of them wanted to restore 18C, repeal 18C. So what exactly are the differences?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, the key issue has been energy, and it looks at the moment as though the energy policy might be different, because it looks like it might be decoupled from emissions reductions. Which is an important step, but they're still talking about emissions reduction. So we might still get this package of policies just under two separate ministers and two separate portfolios, which I just sort of think it's not really a change at all. It's sort of change. It's no change dressed up as being this significant departure from the previous policy.
And so is there any one area that is a real cause for hope, do you reckon, with Morrison? One policy area, I mean.
Well, I still think that the energy policy itself is probably that area, because I think the signs that are coming from Angus Taylor, who is the new energy minister, are really good. The issue is that there is still an environment minister whose responsibility it is, as we've seen in the last couple of days, to reduce emissions. And I think... You can't achieve those two objectives. The problem that the last government ran into is you can't reduce prices, you can't increase reliability and reduce emissions. You just can't achieve those three things. At least you can't achieve it now. I mean, you might be able to reduce emissions over the long term.
Someone invent something.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, there's new technologies that solve problems that we face all the time. But the government trying to force these things earlier than the technology is ready is just not a good way forward.
Absolutely. Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, today we welcome Rebecca Love, who is the director of Freer UK, which is what she describes as a think tank within a think tank of the IEA. Have I got that right? IEA?
Yep, Institute of Economic Affairs.
Institute of Economic Affairs in UK, an organisation very similar to the IPA. Welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So the first thing we want to ask is, just for our listeners that aren't familiar about the IEA, pretty famous organisation in the UK. Give us a little bit of background about that, and just tell us what our people need to know about your organisation.
So the IEA is the sort of foremost free market think tank in Westminster.
Mm-hmm.
It's been banging the drum about individual freedom for about 50, 60 years now. It's had a very sort of strong record of influencing and of putting out very strong, rigorous academic level research.
So not quite as old as the IPA, but you know, it's not a competition.
I'm sure
so.
we can
but we are winning. So not a competition, but we are winning.
It's quality, quantity.
Yeah.
Years,
I don't like her anymore.
No, we're sister organisations, and it's great to
exactly,
be here.
So yeah. Exactly.
Fighting the good fight together.
Just for, I think, really famously, the IEA, before we get into the other questions, helped Margaret Thatcher flesh out her economic philosophy. Is that right? Do you want to speak about that for a little bit, just for our listeners?
So, I mean, if you think about British politics over the 20th century, obviously in the time of Thatcher and also the time of Reagan, this is a time of resurgence of kind of free market ideas. if you look at the kind of political battle in terms of the parties in the UK as well, the Conservative Party has had times when it's been more free market, more kind of classically liberal, and it's also had times when it's been more paternalist.
So now. Yeah,
that's basically what we're trying to fight against at the moment. And freer, so the initiative within the IEA that I direct, like you say, it's, I guess the best way to describe it is a kind of think tank within a think tank. We put out papers, we have events, podcasts like you guys, although we don't have our own equipment. This is very impressive. You have sitting here in your room full of your microphones. That's brilliant. We have blogs. Our aim is to try to push the political conversation back towards that nice focus on economically and socially liberal ideas, which we haven't seen so much of. You might think that traditionally the Conservative Party might be a place for that, or indeed the Liberal Democrats. The Liberal Democrats don't really massively exist so much these days. I mean, they're having some kind of leadership debate at the moment, but they have very, very few MPs. And also, I would certainly argue that their focus on trying to overturn Brexit has shown that they're not only not very liberal anymore, they're also not very democratic anymore.
Exactly, yeah. So what are some of the main challenges that Free is going to be talking about in the next few years, like the main policy areas?
Sure, well, we're trying to be pretty broad. I mean, we've already put out three big papers. We put out an initial kind of position paper arguing why we think this is so important. And our sort of values and principles, we're very much driven by this idea of what we think is fundamentally good. I mean, I keep getting people saying to me, but Rebecca, you know that the popular consensus, particularly among, say, the Conservative Party, isn't for this at the moment. And my point is, we're here to argue that position, not because we think that's electorally just what's going to win at the moment, or that's retail policies are going to get support. That's the whole point, is that we're arguing against what the consensus is. We're arguing because we believe that there are enough people out there who believe in this, but also that this is fundamentally good and right.
Yeah, to bring us back to Margaret Thatcher, that was the same thing she was going through, which was that a lot of her policies weren't exactly that popular with their party, but the IEA and Thatcher knew that they were right.
Exactly. This is a point, you know, that we at the IEA and Freer, and also you guys at the IPA, we have a well-held, rigorous body of work which proposes and is consistent in its has coherence. It has intellectual coherence. This is not something that flips and flops regarding what the current opinion polls are suggesting. It's because we believe this is good and right. So individual freedom, if you look at the way in which in free trade, free enterprise, free speech, all of these ideas based on the dignity of the individual being able to make their own choices, and the way that the market can represent that, has brought about not only massive world-changing goods in terms of, if you look over the last 50 years, then fewer women dying in childbirth, greater education advantages, all of these things which are massive instrumental benefits, but also it's something that is intrinsically good in itself. It's not just the benefits it brings about, but that it, you know, recognising the dignity of the individual is something which is good in itself.
So the significance of Freer is that it actually asks politicians to write policy papers, is that correct?
That's right. So we've put out these three papers so far. The initial position paper, which was written by our two co-chairs. So Freer works in the way that I'm the director of Freer, and then we have these two Conservative 27 intake MPs, Lee Rowley and Luke Graham, who are great voices for individual freedom, for free trade, for free enterprise, for free speech within the party. They wrote this initial position paper, and then Kemi Badenoch, who's also up-and-coming, exciting Conservative MP, wrote a paper for us on free speech. And then Eddie Hughes, another exciting new Conservative politician, wrote a paper for us on blockchain. We have upcoming papers. We have something on the 10th of September, that date is just hot off the press, on housing.
Breaking news. You heard it here on this podcast first.
We bring you the scoops.
That is literally the first time in public that has been announced. We've got an exciting paper, Simon Clark, MP up in the northeast of England, which is the area where I'm from, so I'm particularly excited about that. He's written a great paper about the need to address planning reform. We, like many, many countries, have a problem with access to housing, and it's very much a supply-side problem. So we're looking at that. We've got a piece on the future of work. We've got a piece coming up on transport. So we're going across the board looking at those kind of classic liberal arguments, which bring about not only economic benefits, but also advantages in terms of social freedom too.
Yeah, cool. Because that's something that like Britain can do, but that would never happen in Australia, which is politicians who are sitting, not doing something in like the Conservative Party, their Conservative Party stats, but they'll go outside, they'll work with the think tank, they'll do a policy paper. I mean, the closest thing we got was Dr. Peter Handy writing an IPA review article like 4 years ago. And I think that's like, this is probably not a question you've like been asked before, yeah. but like there are so few federal politicians in Australia and so many federal politicians in the UK, or just like people sitting in Commons.
Yeah.
Is that one of the benefits of having more politicians, that there are people who are like, you know what, maybe leadership wouldn't love me doing this, or maybe this isn't quite what would get me up in the party in the next 2 years, but I really feel deeply about this issue, so I am going to help Freya and the IEA?
That's a really, really interesting question. I mean, the MPs who we have writing papers for us are backbenchers. When you are a member of the government, when you have a government position, you're a minister, there are obviously more restrictions upon you in terms of what the party will allow you to do, etc., particularly if you're going outside of your brief. We have a load of parliamentary supporters, so people who have just agreed. I mean, you know, we are literally about freedom, so they don't have to sign up to very much, just the kind of the value
that
of
can be
freedom.
A lot for politicians, though, to sign I up know. For freedom. It well, can be quite something they're not okay with.
And then you get into these kind of big philosophical debates about what is freedom, and this is exactly the kind of questions, or these are the kind of questions we're looking at. But we have parliamentary supporters, some of whom are writing for us, some of us whom are just coming to events, some of whom just want to say they believe in this stuff. Also important to point out that while our parliamentary supporters so far and our writers have been conservatives, we're very, very keen to engage across the board. We have charitable status through the IEA. We're independent. We are actually talking at the moment to a Labour politician, perhaps coming and appearing on a panel for us in the next few weeks. We've got a Liberal Democrat coming on our podcast. I'm certainly strongly of the belief that the ideas of individual freedom, for free trade, free enterprise, free speech, all these great, like I said, intrinsically and instrumentally beneficial values are not tied to one party specifically. This is something that people in the West, people who in other parts of the world as well, who believe in the autonomy and dignity of the individual, should be able to get behind regardless of party political divisions.
Yeah, I'd like them to be attached to any party in Australia. not just one, but like any of them would be great.
This is similar in the UK, and this is exactly what we're trying to fight for.
Yeah, is it difficult to corral politicians not from the Conservatives into freedom positions? Like, do you have to say to maybe the Labor Party member, taxing big corporations because they've got heaps of money is not our bag here at Freya? Is that tough?
It's really interesting. I mean,
no, Jeremy, so that doesn't quite work for us.
In that we don't have a corporate line. We're interested in people who want to talk about and write about and think about freedom and whatever that means to them. Obviously, like I say, there are different understandings of this. Some people think that freedom as a value is important because of the good other values that it can bring about, whether that's justice or whether that's equality. Some people believe in a more narrow understanding of freedom. So I'm personally, and Freya as an initiative, we're really interested to talk to people about what their ideas of what freedom are. I mean, in fact, we've actually just done a bit of polling. Again, I can't quite announce exactly the results of that, but we're coming out in the next few weeks in line with a piece that Lee Rowley is writing for us on understandings of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So we've asked people what it might be, for instance, that, again, not wanting to give away too much, that might make them more...
I thought this was Scoop City.
Well, I can give the sort of the implications of the Scoops. What it might be that might make people have a better, might feel more comfortable about capitalism, for instance. So we're very interested in looking at people's attitudes to what these concepts are, what they mean. Sometimes, for instance, if you want to, I don't know, you talk about something like economic liberalism, or you talk about something like free markets or capitalism. Something I'm particularly interested in is the difference between capitalism and free markets. Often these terms become conflated, and often people on the other side like to try to push that conflation, to try to push down arguments, which I think are arguments which are inherently good. So we're hoping to look into that and to try to win again the arguments which were won in the past, and to try to explain why it is that it's important we think about these things, not just in a sense of kind of retail policies and, hey, this is a quick winner, but why it is that we want to talk about it intellectually and look at the foundations. I mean, you know, Britain is a country like Australia with strong thinkers. I mean, if you look at the great Australian philosophers like J.L. Mackey and people, and in England we have
Me and Pete,
UK.
Yeah.
You guys,
like the exact
right
that's
there.
That's why it's a good podcast.
Peter Singer, don't agree with him, but you know, you've got great intellectual ballast, as we do in the UK. You know, in Scotland we've got Adam Smith, and in the UK we've got John Locke, and it's about time that we thought about these things a bit more and thought about the fundamental reasons why it might be we want to come up with policies that are intellectually coherent and justified and clarified, rather than just, hey guys, this one is a bit of a vote winner today.
Mm. Yeah, so just to bring it back, like to close the thought about the backbenchers thing, it's so cool that there's the backbenchers who are willing to do this, because like backbenchers in Australia just wouldn't break it, because you know, any backbencher is 5 news polls away from being the Minister for Defence at any second.
Or just the Prime Minister.
Just Prime Minister.
They're like the Labour Party.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, why would I do that? So we were just discussing before the interview, Freya And there was a bit of confusion whether or not FREA stood for, like, well, like, obviously it stands for a lot of things, but the actual word FREA, whether that was
an acronym,
which is good. Like, I kind of think IPA, IEA, three letters is the maximum for an acronym. Do we want to start a competition for people to come in?
A backronym.
Yeah. What is a backronym?
A backronym
use that
like
word
a,
and I nodded. I realized I don't know what that means.
It's when the letters of a word are retrospectively assigned individual words.
Yeah,
so if we suddenly came along and said IPA actually stands for interesting policy activist.
Well, people would say that. People would say that.
What are they? Insufferable something. I can't remember. We get a lot of
Twitter. Yeah. IPA is also a beer in the UK. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it is as well here. Yeah.
I don't know if that's an acronym.
It is Indian Pale Ale.
There you go. Exactly. So maybe we should launch the FREA backronym competition.
Yeah. We get a tweet at us saying I'd rather prefer the IPA beer every day, and I just want to tell people that tweet that it's not that funny anymore, would be my advice. Like, just come up with a better joke. Like, people have done it.
Yep.
Just search your own joke in Twitter.
Twitter can be unoriginal at times.
Yes. cool. So we'll move on. So the IEA does a lot of work with young people in Britain.
Yeah.
And the IPA does a lot of young work. Mm. I mean, we've got a lot of listeners here from Generation Liberty, you know, who are members of the IPA. Yeah. So what are the kind of things that the IEA is doing with young people in Britain
Since joining the IEA earlier this year, I joined, so I do 3 days a week on 4 and 2 days a week as part of their research team. The thing I think I've been most impressed by is their fantastic youth outreach work. I mean, if you get into the office, particularly over the last few months in the summer, there are about 100 interns, there are work experience. They may have the most exciting things. That, I mean, we had this reception a few weeks back and got to meet some of these kids who are coming in and doing some work, and they were doing debates. They'd all been given interesting topics to go and my research. They get a chance to work in the different departments at the IEA. Christiana, who runs a lot of the youth education work, had been organising this conference with another think tank in Westminster, held in Cambridge, where they got access to, you know, to talking to some of the great sort of economic scholars. I mean, it's really, really very, very impressive, the outreach work. And I think it's really important. These ideas, they're interesting as well as being good. And in a time in which things like, you know, Twitter's great for, you know, having debates, but it can become a bit of an echo chamber. And anything, I think, which gets young people thinking and recognising that there are other ideas out there, and the benefit of rigorous debate from whichever side of the political spectrum, wherever you sit, is something of immense value. And I feel really proud to be part of an organisation which does such a great job, I think, of offering young people these opportunities.
Yeah, cool. So we've got a lot of young listeners, and being young in Australia, the rite of passage is to go to Britain for at least a little bit.
Yeah.
So where could young people go if they wanted to become part of this IEA internship?
Great question, James.
Thank you.
Well, I think they need to get in touch on the IEA website. You can find Christiana's email address. You can look on the education sections of the website, see all of the different opportunities. We've had some interns from all over the world just in the months since I've been there. This is clearly, you know, as I said earlier, these are values and these are arguments that you guys are making over here and we're making in the UK. And this is because they have global value. The moment the discussions we're having about Brexit and tariffs, you know, the opportunity we have to help people through trade rather than aid, for instance, these are universal and global arguments, and institutions like yours and like ours need to be working with the young people to make sure that these continue to have resonance in the coming years.
Terrific. Well, we'll move on to our final question, which, of course, a lot of people, we talked about the IEA a few weeks ago because they were the subject of a sting operation by Greenpeace operatives. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
And I should warn you at the start, this is also a sting operation. Because the last one just got a bit muddled in the waters, so we thought up front, this is a sting.
Yeah.
Who are your donors?
So I don't know how your policy works on this, but ours is such that we believe in people's right to privacy, such that if they want to go around and say that they've donated to FREA or to the FREA's funds come through the IEA or part of the IEA, then they can announce that themselves. But it's very, very important that people are able to have the right to, you know, to donate with privacy.
Yeah, we're exactly the same way.
And I think it's really important. This kind of hilarious sting operation. I say hilarious, although obviously it's very, very serious idea that somebody might think it was a sensible thing to try to catch somebody out. And what sensibly, I think the good it has done is that it has shown that crazily, an organization like the IEA, which has a coherent body of work, which it's argued along the same principles for 50 to 60 years, amazingly puts out research along those lines.
How do you people sleep at
night? I mean, it's just quite astonishing. I mean, if Greenpeace want to come and donate some money, I think they'll find that the results of that research will still be along those lines. I don't know how their research organization works, but you know, we're very, very proud of the rigor. You know, we have peer reviewing, we have academic standards on our research, and astonishingly, it keeps coming up with the same kind of arguments in favor of free markets and free societies. I mean, that's just really quite astonishing, I think. But
And then the other side of it is that people are willingly giving money to a cause that they believe in.
Astonishingly,
which was the amazing scoop that I got from reading that article.
Yeah,
free trade is good for the environment, so maybe Greenpeace should give the IA some cash.
Well, the absolutely. Fake organization was called Trade is Good, if I recall correctly.
I think that's right, which is a very kind of I guess it's trade is great. Sort of, I think it's Trade is Great, sort of the Trumpian implication, wasn't it? Obviously, you should have seen through the sting just through that.
Well, I did think it was quite the fake name. It set off a few alarms.
I said, hey, you know, it does what it says on the tin. It's like Frio. You know, we had months of talk about, do we want to call ourselves something else?
Yep.
And in the end, just like, well, you know, Frio basically explains what we do, right?
So it's a good name.
I'm all for setting up a new organization called Trade is Great, in which we look at the economic and environmental benefits of trade, because there's a hell of a lot of evidence out there.
Yeah.
All right, brilliant.
Privately owned giraffes. It's the future.
Giraffes own themselves, you know. Your Peter Singer guy would have something to say.
Yeah, yeah. Was that so? Not a future policy paper.
I'll write it up, and you can see what you think.
We'll consider it. We'll send it to our peer reviewers. And,
Very cool. So, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you to Simon and Rebecca for those interviews. Really interesting chats. Pete, let's fly through some stories we found funny this week.
Let's do it.
And if there's one place I go to find news that makes me laugh, it is Google News.
Yeah,
and
the internet.
Boy, did they deliver this week. Trump versus the media. It's been the big plot line for the last year or so.
Has been somewhat of the theme.
It's been a theme. And huge blow for Trump this week. The top story on Google News is that Google isn't rigged. So I think that settles it. Are we settled?
I think if that's number one on Google News, then it's true.
Yeah. So the actual headline being like, this is literally number one top stories Google News. Trump slams Google search as rigged, but it's not.
It's not.
Number one.
How could that possibly be number one?
It's algorithm based.
There's no
way. It's algorithm based. It is based on previous search terms.
There is no way that's the most popular story in the world right at this second. It's just not true.
I mean, this is like, I think it happened the same day as like our leadership challenge. Like, you think people weren't clicking on Australia's Got a New PM? I'd probably read the Google one over that challenge. So I don't know how Trump comes back from this, Pete. Google News shows that Google isn't rigged.
Well, it no longer has a leg to stand on. How did we find this? Was this just tweeted out?
It was tweeted out by James Taranto. So thank you to James.
Thanks, James.
Yep. So no one out there think it's rigged.
Yeah. Do not ever think that any social media giant rigs it. Okay, so another big story, and I mentioned this yesterday, and how what did I miss? One of the great lefty offs of all time. Nabisco is a company, a manufacturing company in the United States, who makes a product called Barnum's Animal Crackers.
And it's been gone for like 100 years. It's like a huge, huge
apparently
company.
Apparently quite popular in the United States. And what happened was I always get this wrong. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
Yeah, they always get it wrong too, so don't worry about it.
Very sharp. They they hassled Nabisco into changing the images on the front of their biscuit packets from animals in cages to animals striding freely across the savannah, which, to be honest with, I'm quite happy with. You know, that's how civil society works.
Just to put a picture in people's heads, like the previous photo was like all four animals just like lounging in like a circus environment, like just in a cage.
Yeah.
And now they're like strolling all together, which is a bit weird because some of them are carnivores and probably eat the others, but they all are happy and getting along, and it sort of looks like the front cover for Madagascar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks like the Lion King. Daisy Alioto in Vox, however, did not agree with this move because she says the new art doesn't address any of the underlying issues about ethics, exploitation, and corporate greed. And I'll continue, changing the animal cracker box does little to dismantle the elements of capitalism that exploits animals, people, and the environment. So,
Lefty off. It's a showdown.
This is obviously hilarious. That's the main reason we're talking about it, is because it's, you know, ridiculous. But also, surely this shows companies that if you bow to one stupid pressure group,
you'll have
as
to
soon
bow
as
to
you
a
do
million
that,
more.
Someone's going to come on the next day and say, actually, you've got a moral obligation to do blah, blah, blah. So maybe you should hold your ground.
Yeah.
Jamie Oliver style.
This should be it. So if I'm Barnum's animal crackers, the only solution I see is, so they've already moved from the circus to the savannah.
Okay.
I think now all animals should also be reading Ta-Nehisi Coates. Like, they should just be reading one of his articles and just knowing about the effects of post-colonialism. I think that's how you meet them.
I think that's fair.
Yeah, I think that's how you do it. So, this is a recurring thing we've done here, but like, how easy is it to be a left-wing journalist? Like, if you read that article in Vox,
yeah,
she spends a paragraph talking about a family argument.
Yeah.
Like, what is that?
Oh, and the other thing I
don't care.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I didn't mention about this was her great-grandfather or great-uncle or great-great-uncle designed the original pictures.
Yeah, so that's
basically what's caused it up.
So that's the family argument, was like, do we like this? And like, she spends a paragraph talking about like, well, you know, there was like, you know, some part of the family liked it, some others didn't. I'm like, well, I don't care. Like, anyway, the other thing, I want to go back to the Peter quote. So yep. The Peter, when they were like,
the organization, not me.
Yeah. Well, how many differences are there, Pete? I worry about you sometimes. So People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, when they criticized Nabisco for having all the animals in the cage, they said no living being exists simply to be a spectacle or to perform tricks for human entertainment, which has really made me reassess a lot of characteristics about myself. Maybe I don't need to do this anymore.
Yeah, well, this is what I'm saying. Stop.
I don't know. It's a bit of self-growth for me from this story as well.
Stop tying your self-worth to the audience's reaction, James.
Okay, cool. And if you like what Pete says, make sure you retweet the podcast.
That's right. Yeah, exactly right. No, that's true. What was I going to say? So Peter, by the way, so you might have forgotten this, listeners, but Peter sued a photographer for making money out of a picture.
Oh, yeah, the animal selfie.
The monkey selfie.
Monkey selfie.
Yeah, the monkey took a selfie and the photographer flogged it.
Yeah.
As you would.
Yep.
And Peter...
It's like one of the best photos ever taken.
It's like so funny. And Peter sued him, but he got off. So.
Yeah, now Peter's like... Doesn't like a very minuscule amount of Peter's budget actually go towards saving animals?
I'm not sure.
I think they spend more on getting celebrities to take their kid off to protest than they do on actually...
It'd be more sort of activism than...
Yeah.
Operations.
Speaking of activism over actual policy, so that takes us to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Mm-hmm.
So was this mine or yours?
I think this was mine.
Okay, go ahead.
So I'll go ahead. Thanks, mate. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Now, I want to point out, we're not picking on this woman, right? We bag her every week, but it's because she gives us so much good material.
That's the point.
It's not personal.
Look, I have nothing against her personally.
Yeah, but, I mean, like her politics are bad.
But yeah, her politics are bad, but like, just... She gives us so much to work with.
She does. So I like her on that basis. She got caught this week. So she's a socialist, right? She specifically bagged the gig economy and specifically bagged Uber within the gig economy as, you know, exploiting its workers and putting taxi drivers out of jobs.
Yeah.
Her campaign has been found to spend around $4,000 on 160 Uber rides. So obviously she's very hypocritical there. But the second thing you got to remember is... In 2 months, yes, yep. That's true. Good point. These Uber rides, she's from New York, right? These Uber rides were in California where she was lobbying the billionaire socialists for money. So, she's hypocritical on a number of fronts, but it's better to be a pretend socialist than an actual socialist.
Yes.
In her defense.
Yeah, it's much safer and more nice.
It's better for everyone else.
Yeah, that's for true. She just keeps on giving us the goods. Yeah. I feel bad. Like, every week we're like, oh, should we just do what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did this week? And
yeah.
We're like, should we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have to until she, come up with some stuff that's not that good. So she's a congressional nominee for the Democrats.
And like became famous for rolling a huge Democrat.
Yeah, like a more traditional Democrat.
All right, cool. The last story we've got, again, one of those ones that don't really have a policy outtake, but
no point.
Boy, it's funny. So this Twitter user identified as Naomi H tweeted out, "Everyone shut the F up," and use the actual word, "I just got accepted for a NASA internship."
Congratulations, Naomi.
Congratulations, Naomi. That's huge. And then she gets a tweet back from a bloke called Homer Hickam, who wrote Language.
Just a bit of
language.
Bit of family advice.
Bit of. And then rather than heeding the advice, Naomi just tweets back. Can I read this out?
I don't know.
Let's say, suck. She tweets that she would like to Homer to perform an intimate act.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
you get the
because. I'm working for NASA,
yep.
So I'm in charge. And then Homer tweets back, I am on the National Space Council that oversees NASA. Now, it turns out that Homer Hickam is a former NASA engineer and NSC member, bigwig. He also like wrote a memoir reflecting on his career called Rocket Boy. So he wasn't fixing the printer. Like, this is a big, big fish down at NASA.
Yeah.
She doesn't research who this guy is. She's just tweeting at him to, you know, to perform activities. Then she gets a call from NASA. The internship has been revoked on Homer Hickam's orders.
Naomi,
that's a rough one.
I'm your boss's boss.
Yep.
That's what Homer said. Think before you tweet.
Yeah. Or just don't tweet would be my main takeaway. Like, just never share anything with strangers.
Nana, when you got this job, what did you tweet out?
I didn't tweet anything, actually.
Okay. You held your peace?
Yep.
Yeah. Great work. That's
I didn't even have Twitter.
Yeah.
That's what I was doing. Also, I kind of like, so he just, if you triggered by the F word on Twitter, don't go into Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, like, maybe Homer should.
He says he wasn't triggered by the F word.
Yeah.
He was just, like, trying to stand up for NASA, but just, like, yeah. I don't think Twitter's for Homer Hickam.
Well.
Certainly not our mentions after that video came out.
Oh, yeah. Homer
would have blown a gasket.
Homer would not have enjoyed the feedback.
Homer would have been cancelling internships left, right, and centre if he saw our mentions after that Morrison video.
Internships at the ABC and stuff like that. But, no, Homer. Homer potentially should swerve Twitter if he doesn't like the F word. But, you know, in his defense, I think he was kind of saying, you're a NASA intern. I have a lifelong affiliation with this organization. You know, stop selling our reputation.
Yep.
But, as you say, just kind of quite funny.
Yeah, so...
But she got another opportunity though, didn't she? Find her? I thought he was going to, because he felt bad, was going to find her another position in the aerospace industry, potentially.
I don't think so.
That's what the last thing I read. I'm not sure what's happened since then.
I think that might be something said to get the media off his back.
Well, potentially.
Maybe.
Poor Naomi.
Cool. Don't cancel my internship, Homer. Cool. So that is it for the show this week. Thank you to Rebecca and Simon for those interviews. And thank you guys so much for listening and subscribing. Once again, we are available on iTunes, Podbean, and Spotify. So if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star rating. It's a lot easier in the new iOS operating system to do that. So make sure you're doing that. Pardon me. What was that? I've lost it. I've done 3 shows today. My brain is absolutely fried. Where was I at?
Podcast.
Yeah, so it's signing off so you can get lunch.
I'm so hungry.
If you do have other people in your life that you want to get them on the podcast, they always couldn't because they didn't have iTunes. Make sure you're telling them about our Podbean and Spotify pages. Nina, how can people take even more of a commitment with the IPA by becoming a member or a donor?
Well, just join or donate, up to you. Visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button or the donation button.
Very cool. Man, I could keep the show going on and just watch Pete get hungrier and hungrier.
I could just leave.
You could.
I'm not chained to this chair.
Yeah, I could always leave as well.
Yeah, Nana has to go too.
All right, fine. See you guys next week.
Say up. You know, I cherish you.